Our speaker today is Ingmar Saberi of the University of Munich. Is that usually what you say in English?
I think that works.
All right, good. And he'll tell us about twisted 11-dimensional supergravity and exceptionally superalgebras.
Thank you so much for the invitation, Ben. It's lovely to be with you all virtually. I'm going to tell you a little bit about some work that is now on the archive, finally, with Surya, who may or may not be around, Raghavendran and Brian Williams. And this is going to be centered around a sort of suggestion that we've made for what the twist of 11-dimensional supergravity should look like. So I'm going to start with just a few words. I mean, I think of all the places on Earth, this is probably the place where I need to give the least background about what twisted supergravity should mean or why it might be interesting. But I'm going to start with a few words of background nevertheless. So to just dive into that, I should say, please feel free to interrupt me with any questions at any moment in time. I'm very happy to be interrupted. So as is probably well known, depending on who you talk to, but I think in this crowd, it's likely well known. There's a perspective on quantum field theory, in particular on perturbative quantum field theory, that says it should be related to certain moduli problems. So there's a notion of a formal moduli problem, which is roughly speaking the same as an L infinity algebra. That's not obvious. That's an idea which I guess is maybe due to Drinfeld. And then there's some work by Kallak and Griveaux and also Lurie and Pridham, which shows that there's sort of an L infinity algebra that controls any given formal moduli problem. And in physics, this is very closely related to the notion of a quantum field theory in the BV formalism. So if you take a perturbative quantum field theory in the BV formalism, there's a natural way in which it is a sort of local L infinity algebra. And as such, it's related to a particular sort of formal moduli problem. As an example, you just sort of might keep in mind that if you thought about Trin-Simons theory, at least perturbatively, that's related to the moduli problem that describes flat G bundles on your spacetime. And the sort of perturbative L infinity algebra that you would write to describe that is, in fact, just a DG Lie algebra. It looks like differential forms on your manifold with coefficients in the Lie algebra of the gauge group. So this perspective is sort of an interesting one and seems to unify a lot of things very nicely. And there was an early example. Of an L infinity algebra controlling a moduli problem that was considered in the math literature. And this was Kadira and Spencer's theory of deformations of complex structure. Now, that example, it's pretty classical. This was, of course, before the result that says that there's always an L infinity algebra that controls any moduli problem you might choose to write down. And if you wanted to sort of try to interpret this moduli problem as a field theory, looking at it with the eyes of a physicist, you would suspect that it has something to do with gravity. So as a field theory, this wants, I'm writing here, wants to be gravitational. So what do I mean by that? Well, there's sort of different classes of things that you tend to write down in physics, and many of them have to do with, like the example of flat G bundles, some additional structure or sections of some bundle over your spacetime. In general, those field theories will depend on particular choices of structure on the manifold itself where you're considering the field theory. So a typical example, like you might be interested in the sheaf of harmonic functions that's related to the wave equation in some way. And that, of course, depends on a choice of metric, which is viewed as fixed, interested in the moduli of harmonic functions with respect to a chosen metric. So those are sort of field theories. What signifies what a physicist would think of as being related to gravity is something where you've made a choice of a geometric structure on the spacetime and you're interested in deformations of that structure. So what's the classical example of a gravity-like theory or a gravity-like moduli problem? Well, Einstein metrics. That's the theory that's called gravity. And in that sense, you want to think of, like if you look at this with the physicist's eyes, you want to think of any sort of moduli problem describing deformations of a geometric structure on the spacetime as in some way gravitational. In that sense, you want to interpret Kodaira-Spencer theory as a kind of gravity. And there's work that did just this. So there's a sort of famous paper by Bershadsky, Chikari, Oguri, Vafa, it interprets Kodaira-Spencer theory as a particular sort of quantum field theoretic object, namely the string field theory of the B model. And this is sort of another. So what do I mean by string field theory? Maybe I should say this quickly. String field theory is sort of a string theory is a theory of maps from Riemann surfaces into a space. And the corresponding string field theory is a sort of reinterpretation of that theory where you imagine a collection of degrees of freedom in the target space of those maps, which represent the strings moving around in a way that's described by that theory of mappings. And the topological B model is something that doesn't see the Riemannian structure of the target space, but only the complex structure. In general, string theories sort of encode gravitational degrees of freedom on that target space. And so it's reasonable to expect that if I thought of the B model as defining a string theory, it would have something to do with complex structure deformations of the target. And indeed, this is sort of what BCOB's work is about. It writes down what they called the Kodaira-Spencer theory of gravity, just closely related to deformations of complex structure, or more precisely, Calabi-Yau structure on a particular threefold. And they interpreted this as gravity-like. You might, of course, wonder if it's related to a theory of gravity of this other type, a theory of actual Einstein metrics or something like that. And this was sort of pushed farther by Costello and Lee. They formulated a conjecture which says that a version, so they sort of reformulated BCOB theory. Is holomorphically twisted to be supergravity. So for my purposes, it's not that important what 2B supergravity actually is. It's important that it's some complicated moduli problem that includes Einstein metrics, and that it admits a sort of deformation, or more precisely, there is a particular solution to the equations of motion of that theory, where if I look in a formal neighborhood of that solution, I see precisely the fields of BCOB theory. That's related to what Castell and Lee's notion of a twist of supergravity is. So for them, a twist means, in the field theory context, it would mean that a particular superalgebra acts, and I imagine deforming the theory by a square zero element of that superalgebra in a way that makes it sort of simpler. In supergravity, there's actually a sort of gauged action of a superalgebra that extends, if you will, local coordinate transformations of the space-time. And for that reason, deforming by a particular element in that superalgebra is, roughly speaking, equivalent to turning on an expectation value for a particular ghost field for those local transformations, or working in a background in the formal neighborhood of a point in this moduli space where those fields take non-zero values. So twisted supergravity has led to a lot of interesting and active research. Lots of people are excited about this. There's a long list of names I could give. Certainly Castell and Lee, Natalie Paquette, Davide has written papers about this. Also Surya, who's probably here, Raghavendran, Filsang Yu, Jiwan Oh, many, many other people. The thing I want to focus on today is that this precise relation of the BCOV theory to supergravity was a little bit opaque for some time. It was not clear how to take this complicated object called 2B supergravity and explicitly deform it and pull out precisely this theory of deformations of complex structure. And that had a few consequences. So it didn't prevent you from writing down what BCOV theory should be or understanding it in great detail. But a lot of that intuition came precisely from this sort of string field theory perspective. What that means is that because the B model was very well understood, you could sort of think about what should be going on in the target space without worrying about the actual untwisted model at all. People can correct me if this is a radical misinterpretation of the history of the subject. But I think it's fair to say that because we knew so much about topological string theory, we were able to sort of go very far with twists of 2B supergravity without actually ever twisting 2B supergravity. And part of the reason that was difficult to do is that it's just quite annoying to work with 2B supergravity. It's some great big kind of Rococo moduli problem with a lot of fields in it. Certainly it's been written down, but computing the invariance of a particular supercharge or expanding everything in this background that you want to study was not super tractable. And that also meant that other supergravities for example, 11-dimensional supergravity, were harder to work on because there was no sort of world sheet perspective. Or at least no world sheet perspective that you could get very much mileage out of. So what I'd like to talk about today is sort of a sequence of things. I'd first like to tell you about a general result that I guess Brian and I came up with, which sort of streamlines the process of computing twists of supersymmetric multiplets. It reduces it to a computation in finite dimensional Super Lie algebras, followed by maybe a little bit of basic commutative algebra. And it's something that you can almost do on the back of an envelope. Then I'd like to tell you what happens in particular for 2B. We'll get a version of the BCOV theory by doing that. And for 11-dimensional supergravity. Those computations, however, are just at the level of the free multiplet. So they don't tell you anything about interactions in these theories, but they give you at least some partial idea of what comes out when you do this. So that's sort of part one, twisting made easy. Part two is going to tell you about maybe the right thing to write down here is an interacting theory. In 11 dimensions. I won't give you a proof that that interacting theory is the twist of 11-dimensional supergravity, but I'll show you that it's a consistent sort of holomorphic topological theory in 11 dimensions, which passes a lot of consistency checks. It has some interesting properties, so I'll tell you about a relation. To a sort of particular exceptional infinite dimensional simple Lie superalgebra. Called E510. This was written down by Katz in the context of classifying simple infinite dimensional Lie superalgebras of a certain kind. I'll tell you a little bit about some evidence that this theory is actually 11-dimensional supergravity. And then if I have time at the end, I'll talk about maybe a strategy of proof for that fact, which I think would be really interesting to pursue. So before I dive in, let me maybe pause and see if there are any questions at this point. Seemingly not. So let me dive right into the first part. And I'll try to keep this brief because time is limited, but I think it's an interesting result. So there's a way of thinking about supersymmetric multiplets, by which I mean sets of fields which admit representations of the supersymmetry algebra of an appropriate type, which just constructs them using the algebraic geometry of a particular space. And that space is the set of square zero elements in the supersymmetry algebra you're interested in. Doesn't matter which supersymmetry algebra that is, could be in any dimension with any amount of extended supersymmetry. In fact, it doesn't even have to be a supersymmetry algebra. It just has to be a super Lie algebra that admits a grading that puts it in degrees 0, 1, and 2. So in the case of supersymmetry algebras, that's the sort of grading by conformal dimension or scaling dimension, which is typically available. It puts translations in degree 2, odd things in degree 1, and Lorentzian R symmetry in degree 0. And I say space, but I really mean sort of affine scheme. I want to think of this thing as being represented by the graded ring, which is its space of global functions. And I want to point out that that graded ring is precisely H0 of the super translation algebra. In an appropriate grading. So what are the super translations? They're just the strictly positive piece of this Lie algebra in degrees 0, 1, and 2. In the ordinary case, that consists of translations and the supersymmetries that square to them. That's it. So let me call this algebra T. There's a sort of most interesting multiplet that you can build, and I mean most interesting in a precise sense. Namely, I can take just this algebra T as an input and produce a particular multiplet for that algebra. So how do I do this? Well, I'll take the following graded algebra. It's going to be smooth functions on T. If you come from a physics perspective, that's like a free superfield. That's like functions on superspace. And it has two actions of T, both on the left and on the right, just in the obvious fashion. I'm going to tensor this over C with OY. So that's now some infinite rank module, which is free over functions on superspace. And I claim that this is equipped with a canonical differential, which squares to 0. How is that canonical differential constructed? Well, if I take OY, OY is a quotient of a polynomial ring, where the generators of that polynomial ring are coordinates on the odd part of T. The odd part of T also acts on the right on C infinity of T. Those are the operators that in physics would be called D alpha. They're these sort of supersymmetric covariant derivatives. And there's a unique scalar contraction that I can write down, which in coordinates would look like this. So let me just remind you that here lambda alpha are coordinates on the odd part of T, and they're subject to some quadratic equations, which are determined by the Lie brackets in T. So in what sense is this a multiplet? Well, this algebra is filtered. It gets a filtration because T is actually a filtered super Lie algebra. And if I take the cohomology of the associated graded of this object, is this is just sections of a particular bundle. Space-time. Associated to the Kazule homology of Y. So what do I mean by the Kazule homology of OY? I take this graded ring, I add odd generators for all of the even generators of the maximal ideal, so all of these lambda alphas. And I write down the Kazule differential, resolving the sort of cone point, if you will, in this space, or the quotient by the maximal ideal. And the homology of that Kazule complex is the thing I'm calling Kazule homology. And the claim is that this is a well-known multiplet for the supersymmetry algebra that I'm interested in. Why is that? Well, I used the right action to construct the differential. But the left action of supersymmetry on a bullet actually commutes. So I have a strict T-module structure on a bullet. And by homotopy transfer, that induces a sort of homotopy action of the supersymmetry algebra on this particular multiplet. And so if I take, for example, the 2B supersymmetry algebra and I run this machine, I'll find that I get exactly the fields of the 2B multiplet just by looking at the Kazule homology of that ring. So everything reduces to some problem in classical algebraic geometry or even commutative algebra. And it's a fact, this is sort of what this paper with Brian is about, that twisting commutes with constructing this multiplet. In other words, I can take a particular square zero supercharge, view it as a differential in its adjoint action on the supersymmetry algebra. I'll produce another supersymmetry algebra, which is the cohomology, and I could construct the multiplet associated to that cohomology. That would be precisely the twist by Q of the multiplet I got from the untwisted supersymmetry algebra. So that's the sense in which twisting is really just a computation in a finite dimensional superalgebra. So what's an example? If I do 10D n equals 1, there are no odd elements. In the cohomology of the super Poincaré algebra with respect to add Q. That means only the translations survive. There are the holomorphic translations left over. So the theory that I get has to have a space of fields, which looks like holomorphic translations on holomorphic functions on C5. And so this lets you derive, in a sense, without doing any work, that the fields of the twist are just Dilbo forms on C5. This is a result which is due to Beaulieu. It takes longer to do it in components. What if I look at the 2B algebra? Well, the odd elements as representations of SL5, the odd elements of the twisted algebra are bivectors and one forms. I'm computing the holomorphic twist here. There are many options. So in 10D n equals 1, there was only the holomorphic twist. Now I'm computing the holomorphic twist, but it's a choice. I could also compute some other one. Now I've got a space Y, which is defined by having coordinates, which are bivectors and one forms, subject to quadratic equations that say that the contraction of a bivector with a one form would better be zero. That's some variety. And I can look at its Kazule homology. The Kazule homology is a bigraded space because the ring I started with was graded. And I find some numbers. So here I'm writing just this space with its natural bigrading. You can, in fact, put this into your computer. And you see a table that looks like this. You could do better than this. You could work equivariantly for SL5. And then you would find that this is isomorphic to, well, here are zero forms, here are one forms. Holomorphic two forms are 10-dimensional. There's an additional scalar here. This is a scalar. It maps to a one form. And then there's a vector field sitting inside of this 10. it's a divergence-free vector field. And then I've run out of space, but there's another sort of PVC rim hanging out there. And I've been a bit cheeky and put in some differentials, but it turns out that these differentials are precisely the ones obtained by homotopy transfer, if you like, or by doing the rest of the spectral sequence. So remember that the thing I'm writing down now is the cohomology of the associated graded to this algebra A. It has further differentials, which depend on space-time derivatives. And that, in fact, induces a local derivative. It's defined by differential operators in this vector bundle. You can compute what this is, and you get the holomorphic Durham here, here a divergence, and so on. So these are the fields of a particular potential theory. For minimal BC of E. So what do I mean by potential theory? I mean that in BC of E theory, all of the fields that I would write down, if you're familiar with BC of E theory, they would look like polyvector fields, subject to sort of strings of divergence-free conditions. I would have, for example, PV0, that's fine. I would have PV1 mapping to PV0 by the divergence operator. But these sort of Durham-type fields, I wouldn't expect to have. But there's a sense in which by applying a curvature map, I can relate those complexes to complexes of polyvector fields, at least up to some zero modes, which look like PV2 mapping to PV1 mapping to PV0, that comes from this piece. PV3 mapping down to PV0, that comes from this piece. And PV4 mapping down to PV0, that comes from this piece. And now maybe those of you who have seen minimal BC of E theory will recognize that in that description, those are precisely the fields I would have expected to see. So that's, if you like, a proof up to a slight subtlety and at the level of the free theory that the conjecture of Castello and Lee about the twist of 2B is correct. And I want to emphasize that I never actually had to think about the field content of the 2B multiplet to do this. It was a purely, it was just a computation in finite dimensional algebra. Cool. So having done that, we could ask, what about 11D? If I compute the twist of this algebra, the odd elements, they're holomorphic two forms. And the bracket is the sort of obvious one. It says that if I wedge two holomorphic two forms, I get a holomorphic four form. Contracting with the Calabi-Yau form means that that's a holomorphic vector field. So the corresponding space of square zero elements is sort of rank one two forms. That's the affine cone over the space corresponding in 2, 5. And if I look at Kazul homology, I again get a sort of bigraded object. These are the ranks of the Kazul homology groups. And if I were to work equivariantly, I would see that this looks like an omega zero mapping to an omega one and a PV one mapping to a PV zero. And the further differentials I get are just the holomorphic Durham operator and the holomorphic divergence operator. So those are the fields of the twisted 11D sugra multiplet. So I should be careful. What I mean by PV1 in this sort of compact notation is holomorphic polyvector fields, Dolbeau resolved on C5, tensored with Durham forms on R. So this thing is equipped with the differential del plus D Durham. And I'm using the same notation everywhere. So for example, omega zero means a similar resolution of the sheaf of functions that are holomorphic along C5 and locally constant along the R direction. That's how you can interpret this thing as being an 11-dimensional theory. And if I'm careful about the gradings, I find that in fact, this is not a Z-graded BV theory. Of course, it could be at this point because it's free, but it's most naturally a sort of Z2-graded object, which has, well, odd fields that are PV1 mapping to PV0, and then here's a zero mapping to omega 1. And maybe I'll just comment very briefly on why you might expect that it's reasonable to think of this as a twist of a supergravity multiplet. Of course, I never showed you the fields of the 11-dimensional supergravity multiplet, or at least I didn't do that explicitly, but I did claim that if you can write down the algebra, you know what the fields are. What's going on here? Well, in odd degree, I have a copy of holomorphic vector fields. It sitting in odd degree means that it's in a sense part of the gauge algebra. Those are like ghosts, if you will, for particular symmetries. Those symmetries are, well, holomorphic coordinate changes, if you will. So you should expect that in the untwisted theory, there'll be an entire copy of smooth vector fields, which sits in ghost number minus one, which is responsible for gauging local coordinate transformations. And in the twist, only part of that will survive, namely the piece which is compatible with the complex structure in the sense that it's holomorphic. Now, of course, this PB1 is not just in odd degree, because it's actually this entire complex here. It has lots of components. And it has higher components, for example, that look like PV1, 1. Those are even. And those look like particular Beltrami differentials. Those are, if you want, physical fields, since they're even. Those Beltrami differentials represent, if you want, components of the metric in the original 11D theory. It's a way you can think about them arising. And then finally, there will be components of this omega 1 here, which are three forms. So if I look at, for example, omega 1, 2, that's another even field. So it could come from the physical degree stuff. And there's also a three form floating around in the supergravity multiplet. So it's kind of believable, even if you don't trust this computation, although you should, that the things you physically expect to be there have survived at least partially. I should say that work of Eger and Hanner did the twist, not this twist, but the maximal twist in components. So they found a lot of confirmations of the sort of intuition I'm giving you now, where they wrote down the entire set of gauge symmetries in the untwisted thing, and they canceled a lot of things, and they found that yes, indeed, in the maximal twists, things go where you expect them to go. Certain components of the metric survive, certain components of the gauge fields, and so on. Okay. So if there are no questions about that, that's telling you what the fields of twisted supergravity should be. Now I'm going to tell you a bit about what we think the interactions should be. Seemingly no questions, so I'll move on. So there's an obvious way of putting interactions on the space of fields. And all I have to do to think about that or to notice that is to see that, well, this theory is an odd cotangent bundle. If I think about this as being the base, then this is sort of dual to that, and it's shifted in parity. So this is really the odd cotangent bundle to this space of BRST fields, as it should be in a BV theory. And there's a natural Lie algebra structure on the base. Namely, the base is just a resolution of divergence-free holomorphic vector fields on C5. And so I can make that a DG Lie algebra in an obvious way by just equipping it with the Skouten bracket. And then I can form the BF theory associated to that base. So that means at the level of an explicit action functional, what I would write down is, if I just write the cubic and higher terms, the quadratic terms, of course, will just induce these differentials that I've already told you about, namely the divergence operator here, the Durham operator here, and all of these internal differentials, the Dalbars and the D Durhams. That tells you the kinetic part of the, the quadratic part of the action. So I'll just write the cubic thing. What should I write? I should write the anti-field times the gauge transformation of the field. And so this is going to be pretty simple. It'll look like gamma brackets mu mu. This bracket is the Skouten bracket, plus beta brackets mu nu. Those are the only two non-trivial Skouten brackets. And that's, I've built it in a way which makes it clear that that's a solution to the master equation. That's a consistent interacting theory. So if you have seen BCOV theory before, you'll know that BCOV theory is also related closely to the Skouten bracket on polyvector fields, but it's sort of not typically written down in that way. Instead, you write a sort of non-polynomial action. That's what most naturally comes from topological string theory, for example. And here, there's a sort of similar other version of this action. Just another equivalent way of writing this up to a field redefinition. And one advantage of this way of writing it is that the beta field won't appear at all. So this will look just like this. So what does this mean? Well, 1 over 1 minus nu, you should interpret that as a formal geometric series. So it means nu plus nu squared plus nu cubed plus so on. This is actually a non-polynomial action, includes terms of every order. Mu wedge mu, that's a two polyvector field. And so it could contract with a two form to form a function. And del gamma is precisely a holomorphic two form. So this is some scalar quantity. And it makes sense to think of it as an action functional. In fact, there's a field redefinition that takes one of these and converts it to the other. And now the claim is that this action admits an interesting deformation. And that term is, in fact, if I start with this second way of writing I, then that deformation term, which is a cocycle, if you want, looks pretty simple. It looks like this. So how does that work? Gem is a one form. So this is overall a five form. I have a Kalabiya form around. So five form and a function are the same. And if you've thought much about 11-dimensional supergravity, you'll notice that this sort of wants to be related to the Chern-Simons term. That's of the form CGG, where C is a three form and G is its four form curvature. And I write CGG, so that's 4 + 4 + 3 = 11. Now you might ask, there's a coupling constant in front of J. Turns out that I can actually eliminate that coupling constant by a Fourier definition too. So the only important thing about this deformation is whether or not it's present. And so the claim is that I plus J, or this is the conjecture, I plus J is or should be the action for holomorphic Lundy supergravity. I'm not going to have time, I think, to go into great detail about why this is the case. I've given you sort of a few clues that make it look plausible. For example, the fact that J looks a lot like the Chern-Simons term and I looks a lot like BCOV theory. But there are a number of tests that you can perform. Consistency checks that can be made. Let me list a couple of these, and then I want to talk about one or two of them in some more detail. So this reduces to what is conjectured to be the SL4 invariant twist of type 2A. So what do I mean by that? I can dimensionally reduce this theory in two ways. One is along a topological circle. The other is in a way that kills one holomorphic translation. If I do the latter thing, I end up with a theory that has four surviving translations, and it wants to be defined on a Kalabiya fourfold times a topological surface. And there was a proposal, I think also due to Castello and Lee, of what type 2A should become in that twist. And if you take the theory that we've written down, it matches with that on the nose. There's also a further twist that you could examine, which is defined on products of Kalabiya two folds and manifolds of G2 holonomy. Of course, it won't be a further twist of this holomorphic theory in that generality, right? Because to define this theory, I need a Kalabiya five times a circle. So it's only a deformation if I'm working on a geometry that looks like Kalabiya two times Kalabiya three times a circle. But of course, Kalabiya three times a circle is in particular G2. And that setting, I find that this is equivalent to what's called Poisson Chern-Simons theory. And this matches another expectation. So there was a proposal of what the interactions in maximally twisted 11-dimensional supergravity would have to be. And we recover that. The thing I want to talk about in just a little bit more detail is the fact that residual supersymmetry is witnessed in this theory. So in general, in a supergravity theory, the supersymmetry transformations, they shouldn't just act on the theory in the way that they would in a generic supersymmetric field theory. They should do that in a way that's compatible with the fact that local supersymmetry has been gauged. So you can think of that as saying, what is the action of the global symmetry that was gauged in, for example, transcendence theory? It has to be by the zero modes of the ghosts. There has to be a map from the residual symmetry into the L-infinity algebra of fields that witnesses that action. So the action is, in a sense, inner. And that was written down in the case of 2B. So in the case of BCOV theory, there's a map from the twist of 2B, which we wrote down above. It contains odd two forms, odd bivectors and odd one forms. Those map to the fields of BCOV theory in such a way that it preserves the bracket up to one subtlety, which is that a central extension appears. And we'll find that exactly the same thing happens here. So in fact, the cohomology of a centrally extended algebra called M2 brain with respect to the holomorphic supercharge maps to it's the shift by one of the fields. And that's an L-infinity map. So to tell you how that works, I'm going to have to tell you a little bit about how to think about that Lie algebra structure on the fields. We already wrote it down because anytime I write a BV action, I'm telling you what the L infinity structure is on the fields. That action via the shifted Poisson bracket determines a homological vector field on the operators. That's a dual to an L infinity structure on the fields. So we already know what this is, but let me write down its minimal model. Any L-infinity structure has a minimal model on the cohomology of the chain complex that's involved. So there's no differential at all, but there may be higher operations. Let's compute the cohomology. If I use the shift by one, so the Lie algebra grading, let me write it in a different way. The cohomology of PV1 mapping to PV0 is divergence-free vector fields on C5. There's no cohomology coming from that copy of PV0. Other than that, I had omega-0 mapping to omega-1. Well, one forms modulo exact one forms, if I'm on flat space, are the same thing as closed two forms. So on C5. I'm working on flat space, that's important. But there's an extra copy of constants. That's because constant functions map to zero under the Durand differential. And it turns out that this is isomorphic to the super Lie algebra E510 plus this additional copy of constants. So E510 is defined by saying that it consists, I'm being a little bit improper here because really E510 is about polynomial vector fields and polynomial closed two forms, but let me sweep that under the rug. E510 has precisely this in even parity, this in odd parity, And the bracket is determined by wedging two closed two-forms together, viewing the result, which is a closed four-form, as a divergence-free vector field using the Calabi-Yau form on C5. And you'll note that precisely that bracket is induced by the gamma d gamma d gamma term. So the Lie structure is precisely that on E5-10 with an abelian copy of C hanging around. But there is a higher product. So an L infinity structure on the minimal model can have these sort of Massey type higher products. And that's where this constant plays a non-trivial role. What does that bracket do? Well, it takes two divergence-free vector fields, I'll call them mu and mu prime, and one closed two-form, I'll call that alpha. There's a unique way of contracting those to form a scalar. That I'll write that as alpha of mu wedge mu prime. And if I take the constant term of that function, I can view that as an element of C. That's precisely what defines this three-array operation, and it lands in this sort of funny copy of constants right here. So that's, if you like, an L infinity central extension of E5-10. That's what we find for the theory on flat space. Well, what does M2 brain look like? I'll just tell you what its cohomology looks like with respect to add Q. Q is the holomorphic supercharge. It has a copy of holomorphic translations, has a copy of holomorphic Lorentz transformations, that's SL5. And it has a copy of constant two forms here. The bracket on constant two forms, that's the bracket that we already saw when I was talking about Cressmani in 2.5 earlier. It's the bracket in the twist of the 11D algebra. It wedges two constant two forms and it views the result as a constant vector field. Why is this M2 brain and not the supersymmetry algebra itself? It's because there's a central extension here induced by the central extension representing the M2 brain. And what does that look like? That looks like a mu3 type operation, which takes two vectors and a closed two form. And it just does the same thing. It maps this to alpha of V wedge V prime. It's a very similar looking formula. And I'll just close by stating this result, which says that this algebra we've written, H bullet of M2 brain, add Q, maps in a natural way into the central extension that we wrote down of E5-10. I mean, in fact, it maps at the cochain level, but it induces a map that lands in the central extension of E5-10. I'll just write that map very quickly in the last 30 seconds. So the odd elements map to a gamma type field. Everything else maps more or less in an obvious way. So SL5 maps to sort of vector fields ZIDJ. These live in PV1, which is a mu type field. Translations map to the obvious translations, which are, again, PV1 type fields. What about this extra copy of C? Well, it maps to constants sitting inside of omega zero, and that's a beta type field. And in the presence of this gamma d gamma d gamma term, this is a map which intertwines those two Li, I don't know how to count, Li two algebra structures. There's a notion of an L infinity algebra which has only a mu two and a mu three. Both of these are of that type. And this map intertwines those structures. So there are more checks that I could tell you about, but I'm out of time. So I think I'll leave it at that. Thanks for your attention.
All right, thanks. Are there any questions?
Yeah, I have a question.
Go ahead, Kevin.
Yeah, are there other cases for like these exceptional superalgebras appear? I mean, there's a bunch of like, as you know, you twist X theory, you find, you know, vector fields of various properties. Are any of those other ones these nice exceptional algebras?
I'm glad you asked. So there's, had I had time, I would have talked about another check that you can do, which, as you know, is to try and map twists of conformal algebras. In particular, those are the superconformal algebras for the M2 brain and for the M5 brain. You can also write down maps from those. Maybe I'll add this for the sake of fun. You can also do this for twisted superconformal. And as long as I'm not caring about the signature, the M2 brain is OSP 8.2, so it twists to OSP 6.1. And the M5 brain is also OSP 6.1, except that the roles of the conformal symmetry and the R symmetry are kind of flipped. So there are sort of two distinct maps. From this thing, I'll call one of these M2 and one of these M5, and they both land you in 11D fields, which could have been E hat 5.10. And these factor through two other exceptional algebras. So for M5, the relevant thing is called E36. And for M2, the relevant thing is, I think, called CK6. These were both written down by Katz in some old papers. And further, you can show that the twist of the abelian 2-0 multiplet. So that's if you want the free theory on the free limit of the theory on a single M5. You can compute that using the same techniques. I think it's related to, it's related to the Segre embedding of P1 times P2 in P5. You look at the Kazul homology of that and you get this twist. And this has a module structure. for a locally algebra version. E36. So in a sense, you can think of E36 as the natural enhancement of the kind you're imagining for 60 superconformal symmetry. And this map of the twist sort of factors in a nice way through an obvious map from E36 to E510, which in fact I think Katz also wrote down. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it seems like you might think E36 is related to 60 2.0 supergravity.
Yes. I mean, I guess you would want to expect that maybe gauging E36 in some way is related to some 2.0 supergravity theory. I don't know that I can say much that's very concrete about that, but I think it's the right expectation to have. Did that seem like a reasonable pace? I'm never sure exactly how to.
Well, it seemed really good to me, but I suppose I know more of the background than other people. But
yeah, I'm not sure the right pace for me would have been possible in the seminar talk. It's like we would have to sit down and talk about this for 2 hours or something.
Well, I'd be happy to do that at some point if we ever get the chance.
Maybe when you come and visit.
That would work well.
So yes, I think it depends a lot on the background.
Yeah. That's always the needle one has to thread, I suppose. I guess Suri is here. Maybe Suri can tell me if I forgot to say anything important.
I think you hit a lot of. I think you hit all the headliners.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'll make a small comment, which is that I don't know why these Lie algebras are simple. It's sort of not surprising that you see some Lie algebras of vector fields floating around. It's not surprising to see, you could just take any field theory and take the minimal model of that L infinity structure and you would get something. In these cases, you seem to always get something simple. And I don't know what that is supposed to be telling you. I don't know why that would be a criterion that's natural in this context.
But you don't get something simple in, say, type 2B, isn't that right?
That's, I think, type correct. Or...
So, right. Does it say anything? I mean, it must say something about field theory.
Right. I mean, I wouldn't even know what the implication would be for a field theory for its minimal model to be simple, but I guess it should say something.
Doesn't it tell you there's no Wilson lines? Because if there was some finite dimensional Wilson line, it would be a fundamental representation.
Yeah, that seems like a reasonable way to think about it.
So it's simple only because there's no one-dimensional extended objects. In type 2A, there are one-dimensional extended objects, so it might be simple.
Right.
For higher dimensional extended objects, you don't get this algebra. You get some kind of thing you get for the punctured sphere, which is much bigger. It's much bigger, and which is not simple.
That's a nice way to think about it. Yeah, but I guess once you have this local version, you could sort of ask for any dimension, right? You could say, look at the puncture of dimension appropriate to whatever sort of objects you're considering. Will you get something simple there? Generically, you won't.
And then that tells you that you can't really couple to anything because it doesn't have any quotients, right?
Right. Oh, that's very nice.
So maybe you could prove that the only extended objects are M2 and M5 grids.
It would at least be a strategy to do that, yeah. I mean, I guess you'd have to look at... you could just sort of scan punctures in every dimension, and you could ask whether that... I mean, the simple things have been classified. So... yeah. Yeah, you could probably try to do something like that. I wonder if you would have to be careful. So I've been a little bit cavalier about a couple of things. One was sort of the difference between smooth and formal and polynomial for these algebras. And the other was about this hat. So of course you don't get on the nose this simple thing, but you get a sort of infinite extension of that simple thing. But I would imagine that you could be careful about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a graded algebra. For the first issue, I wouldn't worry too much about it.
Yeah.
Just the different completions of the grading. The second, the one with the central extension might be more important.
Yeah. Well, and you want the central extension to be related to the fact that the M2 brain is there, right? It's sort of the one that's coming from this M2 hat. The M2 brain extension at the level of
That's a good point. Okay.
Sure, but I guess it's not, I mean, you don't have anything going in the other direction, right? So you couldn't say not being simple is sufficient for there to exist an extended object of that dimension, or could you? You just have the one implication.
Yeah, I'm not sure. If there was a Lie ideal, you could find some extended object. But...
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So it's not being simple doesn't imply that it has a finite dimensional representation. So
no. Right.
And I mostly do not understand the context, but if there's some kind of compactness, right? Compact Lie groups are semi-simple if and only if they don't have non-trivial one-dimensional representations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there are... I think there's a condition. So in this classification that Katz writes down of simple superalgebras in this infinite dimensional case. Of course, he doesn't do everything. He adds some additional conditions. And it could be that one of those is related to some kind of, I hesitate to say compactness because I don't know what the group is that exponentiates this, but there is an additional property which makes them nice. I could probably...
I think Ingmar seems to have disappeared, probably accidentally.
Who disappeared?
Ingmar.
Oh. I mean, maybe the call dropped or something. Presumably he didn't intend to. But
yes.
Yeah, well, maybe that's everyone's cue to disappear. Let's see. That's just Theo saying he needs to disappear. All right, let's all disappear. Everybody have a good weekend. See you next week. Oh no, you are there. Did your call drop?
My computer crashed.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, that hasn't happened in a while. I don't know exactly what was responsible. Okay. I think what was responsible was that you had asked me a question about like what was going on, about whether there was some kind of compactness. Thanks, Theo. Thanks for coming. And I had remembered vaguely that there is an additional property that these E-type simple algebras have, and I thought that it might have been some kind of nice condition of that type, but when I went to Google it, my computer crashed, so I was being punished for not having remembered.
All right, well, like Theo, I have to disappear, and I will leave it up to everyone else in case they do that.
All right.
Yeah.
There's actually another seminar starting, so.
Oh, that is true.
All right. Yeah. And we'll leave it at that. Take care.
Yeah, thanks, Ingmar. Bye.
Thanks so much.